Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, and thanks for joining the program today. Let's start off by considering our motivation for being here. Ask yourself why you are here, and what answer do you come up with? I hope that those who've tuned in before will say something like, to free myself from all suffering so I can best help free all others from their suffering as well. For those of you who have not been with the program before, we usually try to set just such a motivation, rather than anything else, because at its heart it seeks to benefit countless beings. Of course, we can take in the program just because it will help relieve a bit of our suffering somehow, or we can listen hoping to get a clue about how to free us up from all stress. But such thinking focuses only on one person, one being, and all the other beings on the earth, in fact throughout the universe, feel just the same as we do. They want suffering as little as we do, and they want happiness and well-being just as much as we do. I don't think you'll be able to find one being that says, give me suffering any day over happiness, unless of course that suffering leads to some satisfaction in the future. For instance, a long-distance runner hoping to win major marathons might go through a lot of mental and physical pain during training, but when they finish the marathon or even win it, they count all that suffering as worth it. Their happiness and well-being at that point far outweighs all the suffering they went through to get there. So even their suffering is aimed at gaining happiness. It would be wonderful if we could transform all our own suffering and dissatisfaction into happiness. But that would only make one person really joyful. What about all the countless others who don't even know what will make them happy and keep on creating the causes for suffering? If they can be helped, shouldn't we have the courage to try to help? And that doesn't only mean one or two. If we can help many, shouldn't we do that? Even in worldly terms, someone who helps someone else is considered a hero, particularly if they put themselves in some danger. But someone who saves many people is considered a much greater hero. So think of all the positive potential if you direct all your actions at transforming the suffering of every single being there is, whether in hell or in paradise. But then, if you do want to help in the best way possible, you have to find out how to do it. And for that, we have to look to those who are already in that position. How did they do it? Well, the best being to help others is the Buddha, because not only does the Buddha have the greatest power to help others, but also the greatest knowledge and understanding to know exactly what each one needs. The Buddha can completely read minds, so knows precisely what to prescribe for a person's best well-being and happiness. Knowing this, then, leads us to wanting to become a Buddha, thus freeing both ourselves and countless others. The motivation to attain enlightenment for the sake of all other beings is called bodhicitta. And from a Tibetan Buddhist point of view, all our actions, but especially our Dharma actions, should be motivated by this. Not only will this motivation lead ourselves to liberation, but it will greatly help so many other beings. And that is why it is regarded as the best of all motivations. So let's make this our motivation for the program today. But if you have a particularly vivid imagination and the vision of immeasurable numbers of suffering beings with you as their savior puts you off, then just relax and set an intention to liberate yourself first, and then we'll see what happens later. So now let's take a short silence to make sure our motivation is the best it can be. Thank you. Now once again unto Namkha Pal and his text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. In our last program, we were going through commentaries on the mind training slogan, Don't Strike at the Vital Point, which we saw means we should not criticize or dwell on the mistakes of others, especially when we're in a position of power over them. We saw that criticizing is actually a form of passing our suffering onto others, and until we come to terms with our own pain, even making friends with it, criticism may well become our go-to strategy, but it doesn't work. We saw that criticism seldom brings positive behavioral change because it demands submission, which we dislike, and it devalues, which also turns us off. Feedback is different from criticism because it looks at how to improve rather than focusing on what is wrong. It looks at behavior rather than personality. It encourages rather than devalues, focuses on the future rather than blames, respects autonomy rather than trying to control, and is not coercive like criticism is. So, to avoid criticizing, we have to deal with our own painful stuff first. And we found that to do that, we have to stay with it and not try to escape. As Chogyam Trungpa said, to get out of hell, you have to remain there. You have to go and make friends with your pain, and only then can you be free of your sufferings, and so stop passing it on to others. Which, no doubt, all seems very counterintuitive and hard to do. Well, nobody said training the mind is easy, not even the Buddha. But he did indicate that it's extremely useful and worthwhile if we can see it out. And now, before we move on to the next slogan, let's finish off with a couple more commentaries on Don't Strike at the Vital Point. Trungpa Rinpoche, one of the highest masters in the Tibetan Kagyu lineage, translates it as Don't Strike at Weak Points, and says, this instruction means that even if we see something terribly wrong with someone, we don't point it out to them or hurt them in some way. Also, if negative non-human beings are doing us some kind of harm, we don't do a special practice to harm them in return. In other words, even though we see that someone has a great fault, we don't do something to hurt them. He also says this instruction tells us not to say nice things to someone's face while harboring unpleasant thoughts about them. It is worse than a previous slogan that told us not to run others down, in that it is both deceitful and hateful, whereas the previous one was just hateful. Like Trungpa Rinpoche, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in Enlightened Courage and Jamyang Kontrol in The Path of Great Awakening also make the point that this slogan means we should not do esoteric practices to harm non-human beings. Now, I don't know how much this would apply to ordinary practitioners like myself, who first, don't know any harmful esoteric practices and mantras, and second, don't have the power to make them effective, even if we did. It's probably meant for those with powerful mental faculties who have learned such potentially harmful practices. In an earlier program, we skipped through the life of Melarepa, who, it is taught, had such powers and could do such activities. But most of us who follow the Western lifestyle, I would suspect, are suspicious of such practices and are safe from doing anything of that nature. Both Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and Jamyang Kontrol also say that the slogan means we should not speak or act in a way that exposes others and causes them suffering. So now that's enough on not striking at the weak points of others. And moving on to the next slogan, we find something a little bit obscure. Don't place the load of a horse on a pony. Namkhan Pel does not go much into this, saying only, this refers to slyly avoiding a common problem and passing the unwanted burden onto others. In a more Tibetan context, this slogan reads, don't transfer the dzogchen's load onto an ox. And in his book, The Intelligent Heart, A Guide to Compassionate Living, Dzigar Rinpoche starts by explaining the difference between a dzogchen and an ox. He writes, a dzogchen is a cross between a yak and a cow. Dzogchens are stronger than cattle and give more milk. Because Tibetans are so dependent on milk and butter, the productive dzogchen is a very precious animal. A person who owns 5 dzogchens is considered wealthy. Oxen, on the other hand, are not as highly cherished. On a journey, an ox will have to carry a larger load, even though it is weaker than a dzogchen. Tibetans tend to worry about the dzogchen. I hope my precious dzogchen doesn't get worn out. I hope my precious dzogchen doesn't have to go through too much. I'm so concerned about my precious dzogchen. But the ox's well-being isn't as important. Even if the ox dies, it's easy enough to go buy another one. So there's always a tendency to put more and more of the dzogchen's load onto the poor ox. In this analogy, The concern about the Dzogchen is like our excessive care for our precious self. We are so careful and protective of this small self, always trying to foresee dangers and to take precautions to avoid them. The callous attitude towards the ox is like the way we habitually ignore the welfare of others. What they have to go through is insignificant compared to what happens to us. A small suffering that we may have to experience matters so much more than a large suffering for somebody else. And with this attitude, we tend to shift our responsibilities onto other people, even if they are less capable of handling them. Using our skills, our charm, our sneakiness, we figure out a way to make someone else deal with whatever makes us feel burdened or uncomfortable. And when we fail at something, instead of owning up to our failure, we blame others. To avoid taking the blame ourselves, we make all kinds of excuses, or we purposely create confusion to get off the hook. Since we don't care as much about others, we make them take the consequences of our actions. Even if we only need to say sorry, we try to get out of saying sorry. This slogan encourages us to take responsibility and admit our mistakes. The Japanese culture is very strong in this way. Even the emperors take pride in apologizing when they're at fault. They bow down low and say, "I'm very sorry, it was my mistake." Having this quality gives people tremendous freedom and dignity. Not subjecting ourselves to the uncomfortable tension of creating excuses enables us to maintain self-esteem, even when we've done wrong. Transferring the load onto others starts as early as childhood. I've seen 4- and 5-year-olds do this. They aren't taught by their parents, but somehow they figure out how to use their strength or beauty or confidence to manipulate others. By using our skills to avoid unpleasant situations makes us weaker and weaker. We become more and more dependent on others, and this can go on throughout our lives, even into our 80s and 90s. There are couples in which one person seems incapable of getting up to fetch something or opening the door by themselves. An uncivilized person who saw this behavior would probably think, "Is there something wrong with his feet? Is there a problem with her hands?" Being so codependent makes us very insecure. We know that one day our whole system will collapse. One day we will no longer be able to say, "Honey, do this, do that." He goes on to say that as mind training practitioners, we must be aware of these tendencies in ourselves and change our behavior to be more altruistic. He says, "Since we have effective practices for bringing difficult situations into the path, we can stop trying to avoid them. If we remember that it's in our best interest to continually practice the exchange for self for others, we will no longer be tempted to transfer our burdens onto others. We can even go so far as to accept blame and responsibilities that aren't ours." That is Dzogchen Rinpoche. Now, it's not that because we may be mind training practitioners, we are anything special. In fact, even in worldly activities, it has been recognized that accepting blame and taking on responsibility makes for better outcomes than shying away from them. For example, in an article in the Harvard Business Review, Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners and author of best-selling book 18 Minutes, advises businessmen not associated with our teachings in any way that opening up and taking responsibility is good for both them and their business. He writes, "I was at a party in Greenwich Village in New York City. It was crowded with about twice as many people as the space comfortably fit. There was a dog in the mix too. But it was a casual event, and we all spent a lot of time in the kitchen, cooking and cleaning. I was at the sink washing dishes when I heard the dog yelp behind me. I turned, just in time to see a woman curse at the dog as it dashed out of the kitchen. She'd obviously just stepped on his foot or tail. 'Watch out,' she shouted after the dog, then saw me looking at her and added, 'He's always in the way.' 'Really? You step on a dog, and then you blame the dog. Who does that?' Actually, a lot of us do. We start blaming others at an early age, usually to escape parental anger and punishment, but also to preserve our own self-esteem and self-image. then the behavior sticks, often well into our adulthood. I, and I'm sure you, see people in organizations point fingers all the time. Sometimes it's at a departmental level. A struggling sales group blames a poor product, while the product people blame an ineffectual sales team, or maybe lax manufacturing. Blaming a department or a product feels safer than blaming a person, since it appears less personal, can pass as an attempt at organizational improvement, and might seem less defensive. But it's counterproductive, as the transparency of culpability betrays its disguises. A few years ago, I sat at a table with the leaders of a major stock exchange. They were struggling with setting goals for the year. The CEO, to whom they all reported, was not in the room. I asked them what was getting in the way. "We need direction from senior leadership," they answered in agreement. "Seriously?" I was stunned. "Look around," I said, raising my voice a little. "Everyone in the organization is looking for direction from you. You are the senior leadership." "No," the head of something answered with the others nodding. "The CEO isn't here." I retorted, "You're blaming the CEO? You're waiting for him to tell you what to do? At your level? Really?" An awkward silence followed. Then we got to work turning the company around. Blaming others is a poor strategy, not simply because everyone can see through it, or because it's dishonest, or because it destroys relationships, or even because, while trying to preserve our self-esteem, it actually weakens it. There's a more essential reason why blame is a bad idea. Blame prevents learning. If something isn't your fault, then there's no reason for you to do anything differently, which means, in all probability, you'll make the same mistake in the future. And that will lead to more blame, and it's a cycle that almost always ends badly. Recently, a CEO I work with fired Bill, one of his portfolio managers. Bill was not his real name. He didn't fire him for poor results. He fired him for blaming his poor investment results on everything except himself. The CEO was only looking for one thing from Bill: awareness of the mistakes he was making. But Bill continued to deny his role in his poorly performing portfolio. The CEO was right to fire him. If Bill couldn't admit to the mistakes he was making, why wouldn't he make the same mistake tomorrow? Would you trust Bill with your money? Thankfully, there's a simple solution. Take the blame for anything you're even remotely responsible for. This solution transforms all the negative consequences of blaming others into positive ones. It solidifies relationships, improves your credibility, makes you and others happy, reinforces transparency, improves self-esteem, increases learning, and solves problems. It's as close as I've ever seen to a panacea. Contrary to what you may feel in the moment, taking the blame is the power move, strengthening your position, not weakening it. First of all, because once you've taken responsibility for something, you can do something about it, which gives you strength. But also because it takes courage to own your own blame, and that shows strength. It immediately silences everyone who might try to blame you. What's the point if you've already taken the blame? The blame you conversation is over, and now you can focus on solving problems. Being defensive makes you slippery. Taking responsibility makes you trustworthy. You might think it puts you at risk because others may see an opening and jump on you, but that's not actually what usually happens. I was running a strategy offsite at a high technology company with a CEO and his direct reports. We were looking at some problematic numbers from the previous quarter. One by one, each leader was trying to argue that he or she was not ultimately responsible for the issues, pointing to the other areas that contributed. Then Dave, the head of sales, spoke up. He proceeded to list the mistakes he felt he personally made and what he wanted to do differently in the future. His colleagues didn't pile on. In fact, they did the opposite. They began to say things to dilute his blame. One by one, they started taking responsibility for their role in the challenges the company was facing. Taking the blame serves as an example. When you take the blame, Others get embarrassed about not taking the blame themselves. When they see you don't get shot, they feel emboldened and to take the risk. And even if they don't, you will now be able to avoid making the mistakes you've made in the past, which ultimately is the key to your success. By taking the blame, Dave changed the course of that meeting and, as it turns out, the course of the company. He also got promoted. There is one tricky part of this. To take the blame, you need to have confidence in yourself and your capability. You need the personal strength to accept failure. You need enough self-esteem to believe you can learn from your mistakes and succeed another day. You need to accept failure as part of life and not a final sentence on who you are as a person. In other words, it's okay to step on the dog. It happens. Just don't blame the dog. And that is Peter Bregman. Now, getting back to the slogan, B. Alan Wallace, in an excerpt from the 7-Point Mind Training, uses the Tibetan version, "Do not load the burden of a dzo on an ox," and writes, "A dzo is a cross between an ox and a yak, a very strong beast of burden." So the message is, don't take the burden of a dzo and place it upon an ox, which is a weaker animal. This rustic metaphor refers to issues of ability and responsibility. Each of us is endowed with certain talents, whether we were born with them or earned them in this life. We also have our responsibilities, some of which we may not be inclined to fulfill. If this text were originally written in America, it would probably say here, don't pass the buck. Recognize what your role is and what you're here to contribute. What are your special abilities and responsibilities? At times these will be enjoyable and rewarding. At other times, they may be grunt work. But having identified the grunt work, don't shift it onto other people's shoulders. They may not be as capable as you are for the task. Don't pass the buck. Now, believe it or not, researchers have actually looked into this phenomenon of passing the buck, and www.nbcnews.com reports on a study that showed that, like a virulent disease, it is actually catching. The article by Jenna Brenner is titled "Passing the Buck: Blaming Others is Contagious," and it reads like this. Blaming mistakes on others is socially contagious, according to a new study. Just watching someone pawn their failures off on another can make you do the same to protect your self-image. The result can be detrimental to everyone involved, particularly in the workplace, researchers say. Whatever the blunder, from messing up at work to burning dinner, pointing the finger at someone else or some event might seem trivial. But in organizations where blame is the norm, group members are likely to be less creative and perform poorly, research has shown. The blamer also takes a hit. When an individual is always pointing to external reasons for your mistakes, you won't learn from those mistakes, so it hinders your ability to learn and become more effective, said study team member Nathaniel Fast of the Department of Management and Organization at the University of Southern California. Scientists have shown certain personality traits are part of the puzzle of why we blame, with optimistic people being less likely than pessimists to blame and narcissists more likely to ditch responsibility for mistakes. And then there's the kick the dog effect. It's the kick the dog effect where if someone high in the hierarchy makes a mistake and blames the person below them for the mistake, and that person blames the person below them, and so on. And when there's no one else to blame, that person goes home and kicks the dog, Fast told Live Science. But until now, researchers haven't looked at the spread of blame in social settings to see if the act of finger-pointing is catchy, not just the blame game involving the same failure. The results, which are detailed in the January 2010 issue of the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, also have implications for company culture and the field of contagion, in which scientists have found good behaviors can spread, including self-discipline, but not negative actions, until now. Nathaniel Fast and Larissa Tidens of Stanford University had 100 participants, 70 of which were women, with an average age of 31, read a news clip about a failure of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger with one group's excerpt including a statement in which the governor blamed special interest groups for the failure, and the other participants reading a statement in which he took full ownership of the failure. Later, participants wrote about an unrelated personal failure and had to explain what caused it. Participants who read about the governor blaming others for a mistake were twice as likely as the other group of participants to blame someone else for their own slip-ups. Another experiment with a similar setup, in which participants wrote about a failure crafted by the researchers, showed the same results. Two other experiments were designed to show why blame is socially contagious. In one, more than 100 participants with an average age of 34 read a fabricated news report about a failure by a large philanthropic foundation, with subjects either reading about the organization's director taking responsibility or blaming others for the failure. Participants also answered questions to tease out the possible causes of blame spread, including the idea that seeing someone blame puts you in a bad mood and leads to further blaming. The other idea is that when you watch someone blame others, that observation can legitimize the act in your mind as okay to do. Regardless of whether participants read the blame or responsibility clips, their mood didn't change, and they still considered blame as socially inappropriate. But those who read the blame scenario were more likely than the other group to say the foundation director was protecting his self-image, and also more likely to think protecting their own self-image was important. In the fourth experiment, the team tested out the self-image cause. In a similar setup, results showed nearly 80% of participants in the group that read about blame pointed the finger at others for their own mistakes, while just under 40% of those in the group that read about the main character taking responsibility did the same. These numbers changed when some participants underwent a self-affirmation technique used widely. Essentially, they wrote about a value that was most important to their self-esteem. Just doing this boosts self-esteem and can allow people to be less defensive, Fast said. Those who read the blame scenario and also got this self-esteem boost were less likely to blame others for their shortcomings, with just 35% doing so. The new results suggest when we see someone else ditching responsibility for mistakes, we are more likely to do the same in our lives. The motivator, protecting our self-image. So, there it is. Among all the faults of dumping the load of a horse onto a pony or a zoo onto an ox, one of the worst is that it encourages others to do the same. But that's all we have time for today. We must go now, so thanks for joining the program, and I hope you'll be back again next week. Please dedicate, as we usually do, to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Thank you, and goodbye.
is a member